This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Morning, everybody, and for those watching elsewhere. I've been asked to give a keynote this morning, which I'm delighted to do, and give you a range of perspectives that arise from the Higher Education Academy's work in UK higher education, as well as a flavour from my own perspective about some of the things which both John and Leslie Jane have just been commenting on, which I thought gave an excellent scene-setting experience and context for what it is we want to talk about. I want to widen it slightly, though, because I felt, and I may be wrong in doing so, but I felt very much that the introduction was focused around England, and I need to establish quite clearly that the Higher Education Academy is a UK body and represents and supports institutions in and outside of England in the other three home nations. And there is a very different and diverse landscape there. So while I highlight the Brown Review, first of all, which we all love, and page 45 and page 48 are particularly useful for me because they reference the Higher Education Academy, it won't become the White Paper. The White Paper will be very different, but the White Paper is about England and England only. And David Willetts is only about English higher education, not UK higher education. And it's important that we just give a modest context to the recognition that there are four home nations. And while I, from the delegate list, don't believe anybody from other home nations is here, there were some delegates from Ireland that I can't talk about confidently. But I can certainly draw attention to the fact that Scotland is working on a green paper, and the Curriculum for Excellence program, which is about developing a change in their curriculum from Key Stage 1 to Key Stage 4, is fundamental in establishing how Scottish higher education is changing its approach, and it's in continuing to expect zero fees for students in the short-term future anyway. That's not sustainable, nobody believes, but that's where it is at the moment. Of course, Northern Ireland has a different review going on for its higher education landscape and a different funding model as well. And the Welsh context is again different and quite diverse, with a minister there who is quite focused on a change in higher education, which means diminished numbers of higher education institutions. But nonetheless, a recurrent theme from all four is to value more highly learning and teaching. And that's what my body is about. That's what my organisation hopes to work with and promote. And so the context, which was set nicely, but around England, I felt, is in fact one which is recognisable across the whole of the UK. Aaron, I'm sure, later when he speaks, will refer to the complexity of understanding what might happen to a student who was born and lives in Northern Ireland but decides to go and study in Scotland or Wales, and what the fee will be that they pay and who pays the other part of it, because at the moment that's very unclear, and I'm not going to try and get into that discussion. What is the Higher Education Academy, if you don't know? We've been around for over 7 years, and our role is to support, in partnership, higher education institutions in developing learning and teaching, enhancing the experience of students as it relates to learning. So we're not about making the pubs and clubs better or the societies that they play games and sport in better, but we are about engaging in that learning experience, which they've presumably come to university to experience, and as a consequence of that, for us, raising the status of teaching and supporting and championing teaching is very much what we see as our focus. How have we done that? And this is just a brief list of some of those things. The accreditation and recognition of academic programs that support teaching, generically referred to as postgraduate certificates in teaching, in higher education or something similar, as well as CPD programs which sit around that. And we currently accredit over 370 programs of that sort throughout the UK, in the 140 universities in the UK, as well as other colleges who provide HE programs. We've been running a range of change programs over a number of years. We run workshops and seminars. We do research and surveys, and I'll come back to that later. We run a number of award schemes, the most notable of those being the National Teaching Fellowship Scheme, for which Leslie Jane referred to, and she is the current chair of the Association of National Teaching Fellows, of which there are 422 across the UK. But up until this year, that scheme was only in England and Northern Ireland. We've now encouraged Wales to be part of that, and I'm working aggressively with Scotland for them to see the relevance of being involved in a national scheme. But in Scotland, we have a different program which we run, which is a student-led teaching awards program. Most people in Scotland think it's the National Union of Students that run that. It's actually the Higher Education Academy, so I'm just doing a bit of self-promotion here for the purposes of getting it known that it's ours. And at the core of what we do is a recognition that working with academics in their subject and discipline is where we can have the greatest impact. And so that remains. And there's much more. So it appears that the job's done. Teaching and learning is as it needs to be, and I complete my presentation. No, I don't. The question is what next? Because you know, there are things there which are important, but again, as was, I think, very nicely set in the context of the introduction, as we change the way in which we expect people to pay for and fund higher education, and that in England, as we heard, means a fee which could be as high as £9,000 paid retrospectively when a threshold salary is reached and then removed after 25 years, there is an expectation that students will want more. And we saw that when £1,000 fee were introduced, we saw that when £3,000 fees were introduced, and we'll certainly see it next when the fees rise to a higher level. And that's not unreasonable. And while Leslie Jane did refer to my interpretation, a concern of referring to students as customers, I don't have a concern about that at all. I think anybody paying for a service is a customer, and they have customer rights, customer expectations, and we need to take those expectations very seriously. And that's where I think there's still some work to do. So in terms of what next, I don't think we're there, and I'm going to try and take you through some of that. Professor Graham Gipps, who has done work for us on a number of occasions, and probably one of the most respected UK researchers in looking at quality in higher education, produced a publication for us last year called Dimensions of Quality. And while it was a meta-analysis rather than primary research, and while it didn't try and define what quality was, it did identify a number of characteristics which were linked to quality. And this is supported by previous work that Graham has done earlier in this century, which did look at quality, and he's been consistent in being able to establish there are some things that we do know about quality that we can make use of, and I'm referencing some of them here, such that the class size is important. And many of these things, of course, can relate to and do relate to the key information set that we are all beginning to experience and prepare for our universities as well. The quality of feedback that students get, who undertakes the teaching, the contact between that member of staff or that individual academic and students is also something which provides students with a better experience. And what he found through correlation here was that when those things happen, students perform better. Okay, now, that's not terribly robust. It's good evidence. We can make use of it. What needs to happen, in my opinion, is a systematic review of the quality markers in higher education, which we can begin to profile more highly, and establish as well whether or not, something which I'm quite outspoken about, and I'll come on to in a moment, and that is whether people who are qualified to teach in higher education are in fact getting or giving students a better learning experience. The perception would be that it's yes. The anecdotal evidence is clear that it's yes. But the hard empirical evidence at the moment is still quite fragile. The Academy does a number of things I referred to before. Some of those are surveys. We run a postgraduate tour survey and also a research survey. And what I'm highlighting here for you is that both the National Student Survey run by Ipsos Mori, as well as our own postgraduate tort survey, which we don't release to the league table compilers and don't intend to, have both demonstrated that in terms of overall satisfaction, there is pretty high satisfaction for the teaching experience that undergraduates and postgraduates have in UK higher education. When the survey was first introduced, the National Student Survey, Bill Rammell, who was Minister for Higher Education at the time, and the first survey, I think, produced an average of around about 80% across the UK. And he was quite complimentary, saying that if students are feeling that 80% of their experience is satisfactory, then we've got a very, very positive higher education sector. And I think he was right in saying that. What's tended to happen over the 6 years since then is that governing bodies and councils of universities have beaten universities up over the scores they've achieved, breaking it down into the factors within that, which I'll come on to in a moment, and perhaps raising concerns about the quality of teaching or the student experience that individuals are having in UK higher education. And I think that's probably slightly unfair. Certainly if this was a room full of vice chancellors, I can guarantee very few of them would be sitting there saying right now, we think the quality of teaching in UK higher education is substandard. They wouldn't say that. They wouldn't be prepared to say that. But we can ask a different question, and that is, can it be improved? And I think most of them would say yes. And if we look at the next slide, where you see that both our postgraduate tort survey and also the National Student Survey, both have identified that things such as feedback and assessment are still areas of concern. And we all know that. I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. But look at the figures. 56% in our survey were concerned about feedback, 58% concerned about feedback to help clarify their understanding more recently, and 67% as a satisfaction rating for the National Student Survey. They are still good figures. You know, if you were getting that in a piece of assessed work, you might be happy with that. But I would often liken these things to you going to your GP and saying, if your GP was getting your diagnosis correct 56% of the time, would you be happy with that? Would that be the doctor you'd continue to go back to? 67%, you might feel a bit more comfortable, but as you get a bit more aged, like me, then these figures become a little bit more important to you and you want the figure to be closer to 100%. So it's a metaphor, an unhelpful one, but nonetheless, I don't think we should be complacent in saying this is where we're happy for it to be. In addition to that, over a number of years now, we've been running a project called Teaching International Students, called TIS, in partnership. And these are just a few of the identifiers, and I'll go on to some slides in a moment to explain why I'm telling you this, about concerns students coming from outside the UK have about their experience here in the UK. Unclear expectations, background knowledge was lacking, language can be an issue, assessment remains a concern, making friends and being integrated into UK society and UK classes is extremely problematic. There is clear evidence which shows that British students are extremely British-centric and do not engage openly with foreign students. There are issues, which I don't report here, around the achievement of international students as well, who are achieving less than, their overall grades are less than home EU students. Now, that can't be right, in my opinion. And so projects of this sort are about enlightening us on areas of concern, things that we can do, and hopefully making some change. One particular question here, which has been repeated over a four-year period, shows that in terms of the question, are you satisfied with the enthusiasm of academic staff, has shown a shift over a four-year period in which that difference has diminished to only 4% from 6%. Neither of those figures is too big, but I would be concerned that if staff weren't being enthusiastic, that we should understand why. What is that about? And again, anecdotal reports, and I've had a lot of these about staff who have taught classes which have large numbers of non-British students and non-EU students, sometimes presents a disturbing scenario in the way in which people engage with those classes, and that's the academics I'm talking about, not the students. Why is it important? Because at the moment, there are nearly one in five of every one of the students in the UK who are not British citizens. And so UK higher education is a huge market opportunity, and I don't see it as an income-generating activity, but nonetheless, it is a market opportunity to globalise the brand of UK higher education. But that'll only work and only be sustained if we get it right and if the quality is acceptable and if the expectations of the students are as we would want them to be. Again, Leslie Jane referred to the didactic nature of the history of higher education in the past, and I hope it's less didactic now than it used to be, although to some extent I'm being didactic today. I do apologise. But many foreign students actually come from a didactic experience, and when they enter UK higher education, they are often not well skilled or understand the nature of the learning environment they're entering into. The Teaching International Students Project has identified that. What we need to do now is to work more consistently in helping academics across the UK understand that and become more capable of doing so. But look at the impact. The Economist presents some figures here on the impact to the economy, £25.4 billion arising from the foreign student population which comes into the UK every year. I don't have the figure here, but it's nearly 400,000 students who are in UK higher education in this country, and a similar figure outside the country, which I'll talk about in a moment. There are 3 million students at least seeking worldwide international higher education experiences. So this is a huge, huge market. And that in itself underestimates where there are also areas of extreme development. In Bangalore alone, in India, a province I know very well, with a population of 50 million people, has an undersupply by 2 million of university places that particular province requires. They just don't have the universities, they don't have the places, so there are 2 million people wanting to do higher education, can't get access. It puts into perspective, perhaps, but doesn't diminish, the fact that 155,000 students last year were unable to get UK higher education places and therefore had to find alternatives, which may have been entering the workforce, may not have been entering the workforce, or may have been going to study somewhere else, which I'll also make comment on. So overseas, 388,000 students being taught on UK programs. Some of them, like, for example, Nottingham University, in Nottingham University-owned campuses, one in China, one in Malaysia. But most universities who teach programs overseas, and there is a large number, are actually teaching them in partnership with small colleges, sometimes private organisations. And what concerns me around this is that we might have a framework of standardisation, quality assurance expectations here in the UK of what we want academic staff to be and the learning environments that students will experience. That same oversight is not given to overseas students. And I'll just use one very simple example. Of course, in the UK, we're required to become compliant with European legislation around disability access. So there need to be lift accesses or rooms made available for people who are disabled and unable to be as mobile as others. That doesn't exist in very many, if any, overseas campus provisions where UK degrees are being taught. Now, I'm not saying it's a problem, but it's a dilemma for me in that how do we justify that overseas when we are not allowed to do that inside the UK? Are we confident the standard and the quality of the teaching overseas is as we would want it to be? And would those people be acceptable in universities that we have here in the UK? They're questions which are rhetorical to some extent, but I think they raise for me the entire notion that professionalisation of teaching, something touched on by Leslie Jane, and I think she said you were supporting that, that was what I hoped you were saying, is something that the Academy believes very strongly in, and I will make more mention of that in a moment. So international students have a huge impact on the economy. Again, making some comments from a slide previously, it's self-explanatory in terms of what it's saying there in reference to the number of jobs, the way in which it impacts positively on the economy. And certainly the UK Department of Trade and Industry has recognised that in recent years, that international education in and outside the UK is of benefit to the UK's economy. So the Academy, professionalisation of teaching, professional recognition, is it important? Is it something that we want? There's 180,000 academics teaching higher education programmes in the UK. The Academy runs a fellowship program which is benchmarked against the UK Professional Standards Framework, which I'll talk about, and we currently have around about 28,000 fellows. Now, there are other qualifications and other routes to professionalisation in higher education. I'm not saying the Academy should be responsible for all of that, and I'm not saying it is responsible for all of that. What I am saying is I think it's important that people are recognised. Again, back to your doctor. Your doctor's got to go through accreditation programs every year, gaining points to prove that they're engaged in CPD and maintaining their contemporary knowledge and awareness to what's happening in medical practice. And that happens in most professions. If higher education teaching is a profession, then why is it not professionally regulated? Why is it not required to be qualified? It is the only part of the state-funded, and I do still believe that higher education is state-funded, but it's the only part of the state-funded education system where that's the case. If you teach in primary school or teach in secondary schools, you must hold a qualification to teach. You get into higher education and anybody can come through the door. It seems peculiar to me. Now, if you work in a private funded school, that's not the case. You can, again, walk in through the door and become a teacher in a privately funded school. They do have standards, but the point is anybody can come in. There are very few professions in which that's the case. And there is still a fair bit of reluctance to accept that this perhaps needs to change. But if we go back to the consumer's point of view for a moment, the student, and with the publication of key information sets, which is not a requirement, but may ultimately become a requirement of government policy throughout the UK, things such as staff-student ratios, contact time, employment opportunities, possibly the number of staff who are professionally qualified, may become a requirement of that key information set. On a personal level, I don't support it being in there, because if it is in there, what's going to happen is the Vice-Chancellor is simply going to say, I want you all professionally qualified. Go and get the certificate. Go and get the professional recognition through the Academy or somewhere else. Come back and tell me you've got it and I can put a tick next to your name. It defeats the purpose, in my opinion, because what I want is the proof, which I don't have yet, that by being professionally qualified you are a better teacher, you provide a better learning environment, students are doing more successfully as a result of that, and therefore there's a reason why it's being done. And so I don't personally support its legislative inclusion in the key information set. I've mentioned this a couple of times. This was established back in 2006. Some of you will be very familiar with it. It's a sector-owned standard framework, a threshold. It's a minimum threshold, by the way, as well. So it's basically saying, can you walk and talk and stand in front of a class? I'm being disparaging. Therefore, yes, you can be a teacher. All of the postgraduate certificates being run by universities in the country are standardised against this, and there are two particular descriptors which I use. One is called Standard Descriptor 1, the other Standard Descriptor 2. There is a third one as well. But the second one, Standard Descriptor 2, is what we would expect of staff who are teaching regularly in higher education. Standard Descriptor 1 is what would be offered for and taken by somebody who was perhaps a PhD student or a graduate teaching assistant who did some demonstrating, perhaps some classroom monitoring and tutorial work, but may not be a regular and consistent teacher. The framework was set up in 2006. The Academy was asked to oversee it. As I said before, 378 programs are accredited across the UK. That includes postgraduate certificates for higher education or their equivalent, and a range of CPD programs, some universities being much more engaged than others. We've recently done a review of this in December 2010 through to January this year. We sent out a review of the framework with some very focused questions. We chose to take, and it was my fault, and I've apologised to most people I need to apologise to. Sorry again, Julie. We took a very focused approach in that I was keen to model our review of this process along the lines of something that the Welsh Funding Council had done a few months earlier, which was to send out a review of their funding methodology. This predates the Comprehensive Spending Review and the diminution of money to all home nations as well, in which they put a question on their survey to HEIs in Wales saying, in future we intend to fund the teaching grant in Wales institutions on the basis of your National Student Survey scores. I'll just leave you to resonate on that for a moment. And, of course, everybody was equally excited as you were about that prospect and said, that's great, fantastic. They got 100% rejection for that notion, and they quickly dropped it from their proposals. Of course, history has now moved on a bit from that, but they dropped it from their proposals. So we took an equally challenging approach to the professional standards framework, using language such as the Academy requires, the Academy insists, the Academy wants, the Academy, you know, whatever else, in certain areas of what we thought should or could happen in terms of how we recognise teaching. Now, I got widespread criticism from the sector about this, particularly from vice-chancellors. My own chair of my board, who is a vice-chancellor, had subsequent to this suggested I might have put it in front of him first and he would have warned me about the backlash that I'd get. I'm happy to accept the fact that I made a mistake, and I've apologised to everybody I meet in doing so. But what I don't apologise for is the response I got, because I got over 210 very, very focused responses in the same way the Welsh Funding Council did. People polarised themselves, and that's what I wanted. I did not want a bland consultation with people saying, well, it doesn't matter. I wanted them to tell me what they thought, and they did. And we got some very, very powerful responses about things, and so some of them are listed here. It's not for public dissemination yet. It's only just gone out to our board last week. They're broadly happy with the report that we've produced, and that will become publicly available very soon when it's gone through some other boards in, for example, Universities UK, Guild HE, the four funding councils, and so on. But it showed broad general support for the framework existing. It asked for us not to create a one-size-fits-all model, which we didn't want to do anyway, that it was a potential key indicator for how teaching in UK could be judged. There was support for things such as peer observation of teaching, which currently doesn't exist in the program. So it's given us a wealth of knowledge and data about what the sector will support and how we might remodel the framework. And there is no guarantee that we'll remodel the framework. We intend to look at this now and decide, is there a framework that needs to be improved, enhanced, developed, and again, it will be put to the sector for consideration. International perspectives, very quickly. The Australian Learning and Teaching Council, which is being closed, it was announced earlier this year that it would no longer be funded, is an organisation not unlike the Academy. And they've done some great work over there. For example, the National Teaching Quality Indicators Project established a teaching quality framework which has been used across Australia, piloted in 8 institutions, first of all, and now being widened out beyond that. And they've got some very creative things going on there to try and recognise the values and the characteristics of good quality teaching which they want to enhance and put into their systems and structures through review, through promotions and so on. And I just mentioned there again University of Western Australia and a teaching recognition project which they've been doing. On an international level in the USA a number of years back, a project called Broader Impact was introduced around research funding, particularly from the National Science Foundation. So if universities gain or individuals gain research funding from the National Science Foundation, they are now required to demonstrate through their proposal, and therefore if they're successful, how the research outcome will be used to inform teaching, how it'll be used to widen knowledge awareness and make the information from that not merely research projects and publications but part of teaching, knowledge dissemination and transfer into and out of the public domain. And that's been a very successful project. My question here, rhetorical one, Is that a model for the UK? Because research councils at the moment don't require, very often anyway, the links between research to be related to what's happening in a university's teaching program as well. We ran a blog on The Guardian a few weeks back, and it will continue. They were quite happy with it and want us to do another one. I simply put a quote here from an individual who responded to the article that we wrote, highlighting some of the things that might happen in the future. I'll read it to you. British HE should follow the lead of the US and start to take teaching seriously. Otherwise, now that the financial cost is not terribly different, I expect the savvy UK students will start to go elsewhere for their higher education. Now, 155,000 students couldn't get places last year. Maastricht University and a number of others ran some fabulous adverts in the UK, I thought, brilliant adverts, saying, come and study in Maastricht, taught in English, staff student ratio lower, fees lower, multicultural experience, live on campus. It looks very appealing, doesn't it? And I said to my daughter, who's about to go to university, have you thought about this? It's very attractive. There are some fantastic models out there. If we do not respond, the customers, the students, will respond for us, and it may not be the way we want. Just recently, the German government announced a 2 billion euro 10-year project to support learning and teaching. Fantastic investment. I'm not saying the same should happen here. We've had quite a bit of investment in learning and teaching over many years through the settles, through the academy itself. Not as much as that. But nonetheless, that's a very impressive intention to ensure that learning and teaching is more highly profiled. And the quote at the bottom there from their Minister for Higher Education, Annette Chauvin, we want more recognition of the value of university teaching. Exactly what the four home nations, ministers for higher education, are all saying. They want it to be raised in awareness. We've been funding projects for a number of years, some of them in reward and recognition, undertaken by a settle that still exists in Leicester University called the Genie Settle, which is about genetics. But Annette Cashmore has done some fantastic work there looking at reward and recognition strategies across the UK. And when she published her first research on this in 2008, what she found was that reward and recognition was not systematically recognising learning and teaching as part of promotions processes in universities. Where it did exist in form in the documentation, staff were sceptical about its relevance and its use and felt very strongly that research was what mattered. And again, we heard that comment earlier. She's just done a repeat study of that sort. It will be published later this year, and my understanding is that the findings are disappointingly very little different than before. That's worrisome. So in summary, I support very strongly the professionalisation of teaching, including its reward and recognition, and I do believe that there are things that we need to do if we're to retain the quality of teaching as it's perceived now and into the future. I think qualifying teachers needs to be looked at very carefully, and a package of measures to raise the status of teaching still need to be included because they're not there yet. We do need the evidence, and I talked before about that, and it's work that the Academy is at the moment having discussions about how we can create a longitudinal study to look at what are the things that will make a difference to teaching, learning and teaching, and the quality of the student experience that are related to professionalisation. In America, again, just as an anecdote, Bill Gates last year, his foundation, has funded a 3-year project looking at what quality markers of teaching exist in secondary education. Secondary education, nonetheless, we can learn from that. 2.4 billion students in the UK, they deserve a better experience, in my opinion. We need to try and give it to them. Thank you very much.